This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because our microphones create one all across the state this time of day. The real Main Streets, where we meet and greet our friends and neighbors and talk about what's on our minds, are important. Well, they're the heart of our communities out there, and that's why we call our show Main Street. We like to think that we provide a little heart and soul as well, particularly during a short and sweet membership drive. Danielle, I'm joined by Danielle, and of course in studio, because it's time to remind you that we are member-supported radio. We love our listeners, but members keep the lights on, and this is your opportunity to get a one-pound box of cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry with a membership of $10 a month, $120 a year at Prairie Public. And it's easy to do. Just give us a call, 1-800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org.
Yep, and we do, we definitely call this the short and sweet membership drive because it is very short. We just started it on Wednesday, so that was 2 days ago, and it's wrapping up tomorrow,
yeah.
I believe, at noon central. So once that is over, it's over. And it's basically one of those things where, like, you can blink and you'd miss it. So we're hoping that you won't miss it and that you will give us a call this afternoon. We've got volunteers standing by right now to take your phone call. 1-800-359-4145. That's 800-359-4145. Or you can pledge online at prairiepublic.org. And as Doug just mentioned, that $10 a month level will secure that membership in Prairie Public so that you support the programs like Main Street that you hear every day here on Prairie Public, as well as All Things Considered, Morning Edition, just all your favorite programs. They cannot be here without member support. So you secure it, you help to make it happen. And as a thank you, we send you that box of truffles for free. If you want more truffles, you can definitely speak to our volunteers about that and they will hook you up. But it's probably our members' favorite drive. It's a very popular drive. We love to talk about it every year too. It's personally my favorite drive because I love chocolate so much, it's just always a good time, and we hope that that you'll call in right now and make that membership support.
And for those of you who have made this your Valentine present of choice for years now, because this is the 19th year we've done the short and sweet drive, you can be excited by the prospect of something a little bit different in the truffle box this time around. It's not a lot of money or anything like that. It's just a kind of a clever change, a little sweet idea to add to that one-pound box of delicious truffles. And it's very easy to do. Just give us that call, 1-800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org. Our members are the most vital form of support we get. We have a pie. Imagine that. The biggest slice by far is membership. And that size of that slice tells us how big that grant slice is going to be. And, of course, as you probably know, the North Dakota slice got a little narrower last year because the state was going through a budget difficulty. So that came our way, too. So now we're asking our members to make that slice a bit bigger. Isn't that right, Danielle?
That is right. A lot of our other funding sources are contingent upon member support. So a lot of times what they'll do is they'll look at, you know, what our member revenue is and be like, okay, well, if you're not getting this, then maybe we don't need to give you that. But we're really always very impressed by our members. They always step up to the plate and come through for us. And we know that you're doing that again this time around. And if you haven't made that membership pledge yet, now is the time. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org.
I'm joined now by James Grady. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. area. Hello, James.
How you doing, Doug? Good to talk to you.
Very well, thank you. And Keir Graff, who joins us by phone from Chicago. Keir, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
James and Keir are the editors of Montana Noir, which was released in September of 2017. It is, as the title suggests, a collection of short stories that are dark. And let's get a little background first. This is Akashic Books. It's been putting these noir collections out, Keir. Give us a little background about them.
Well, yeah, Akashic is a very interesting publishing house. It's formed by a guy named Johnny Temple, who started out as a, I don't know if we'd call him a rock star, but he played in a very influential kind of indie band and branched out into books and started publishing a lot of unusual, just an idiosyncratic but fascinating list of titles. And I think they sort of stumbled into crime fiction a little bit. And Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, I think Brooklyn Noir was the first one?
That's, as far as I know, yes. Brooklyn is the neighborhood where the publisher works and lives, so we thought, let's see what's going on in my own back door.
So they sort of commissioned an anthology of short stories with the crime fiction bent, and it was successful, and they did another one and another one and another one, and now it's, after many years, it's a worldwide success.
Yeah, I counted over 100 titles that have either been published or are in the works. James, some people might know you by your first novel, 6 Days of the Condor, which became a movie with a shorter duration, 3 Days of the Condor, starring Robert Redford. So you're both Montana natives, right? James, where are you from?
Absolutely. I'm from a small town called Shelby. It's about, 60 miles east of the Rockies and 30 miles south of Canada, just north of Great Falls. It's a great place to grow up and to really get a chance to ease into life.
And, Keir, you're from Missoula, Montana, originally.
That's right. The mean streets of Missoula. Grew up just a couple blocks from the campus of the University of Montana.
Well, I researched both of you a little bit, so I know there's an age difference here that's somewhat significant. How did the two of you become collaborating editors for Montana Noir?
We ran into each other at a literary conference, and it was like a fusion of like minds and a desire to try and bring fiction about Montana into the forefront of the really international publishing scene through Montana Noir.
Well, these are a very entertaining collection of short stories. I've read several of them, including, James, your short story, The Road You Take, which is set in your hometown of Shelby, Montana. What were the deciding factors in your selections for the book here?
Well, we commissioned the stories, and so really the important part was to choose the authors more than the stories.
Uh-huh.
We chose the people that we thought could deliver what we were looking for. We chose 12 authors in addition to ourselves who we thought could represent the diversity of the state. I mean, Montana is a big state with a lot of variation in terrain and mentality. And we kind of let people know what we wanted, and we trusted them to deliver it. And what we wanted was not some version of Montana that was trapped in amber or felt like it was from the frontier, but we wanted something that was contemporary and that was very, very much alive to the issues of the day.
Do all the authors have a Montana connection?
Absolutely. There, I think about just under half of them still live there or have just left there for various personal reasons. But everyone has to have a Montana connection in order to make this anthology.
Well, this must make it a pretty popular book in Montana.
It certainly is. As I recently heard from the publisher that the first printing is nearly sold out, so I think it's doing pretty well.
Well, we look forward to a North Dakota noir one of these days. How long did this process take?
Well, Keir and I actually spent about just under 5 years getting the whole thing off the ground and convincing the publisher that not only were we serious, but that we could deliver a book that would be economically feasible. And it was just one of those labor of loves that you never let go of.
So
we met back in 2009 at the Montana Festival of the Book, the year they were honoring Jim Crumley, and that was when we first made our connection, and it kind of kept popping up over the years between then and the time we finally were able to put it to bed.
So 5 years collaborating on Montana Noir. Well, what were you doing, to keep the lights on in the meantime? Keir, you work for a book company, don't you?
I work for a review journal, a book review journal called Booklist that is published by the American Library Association. So I work very much in the book world. I also publish books for kids, kind of middle grade age kids. For most of us writers, the writing itself isn't the thing that keeps the lights on, so everybody's got a side hustle. I've got a full-time day job side hustle as the executive editor here at Booklist. But most writers I know Jim's the same way, we've always got multiple irons in the fire.
Well, how about you, James? What are you doing besides...
Well, I've been lucky to keep most of my hustles in the literary or journalism field. So I published a couple books about why I was working on Montana Noir. I do some journalism. I have a very, as does Keir, very helpful, supporting, and encouraging spouse. Our wives deserve a medal.
Well, James, as an experienced screenwriter, do any of the stories in Montana Noir read as prime candidates for a film treatment?
I'd say there are at least two or three there that, with the right director and producer, could become one of those great Friday night films you see in Fargo and you go, you remember it. Cross your fingers for those authors.
Keir, I should have asked this right away, but if you were, if a reader came up to you and said, I'm interested in Montana Noir, what do you mean by noir?
Well, noir is one of those subjects that everybody defines a little bit differently. I tend to think about it as, you know, I mean, film noir is what most people associate with that word, right? Mm-hmm. They think of black and white movies. They think of kind of quippy banter between somebody in a fedora and a dame with a gun on him or something like that.
In a big dark city. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And certainly in Montana Noir, one of the things we maybe had to struggle against a little bit was this concept that it is an urban phenomenon. But Jim and I really define it as being, you know, it's about struggle. And for me, it's certainly about people who are faced with maybe, you know, two bad choices. It's about people coming up against forces that are greater than them, or maybe forces that they barely even comprehend. And it's often about, you know, the everyday person getting kind of crushed by society or forces beyond their comprehension. So it's dark, heavy stuff. It's often, to me, there's often a political element. You know, it's not crime fiction that's just for thrills. It's not people beating each other up for the fun of it. It's for us, it's certainly heavy issue-laden stuff.
And one of the things that I think that we both love about the concept of noir is these are stories from the West and the small towns and the small cities that we grew up in and that we know. They're not tales of glittering Hollywood or you know, overpowering New York. These are tales of real people in real times that everyone in your audience can look out and go, hey, I know somebody like that.
Well, you've had some interesting people go through Shelby, Montana, at least according to your story, the road you take. Do you want to tell our listeners, give them a sort of a general picture of what this story is about?
I discovered this phenomenon, and it's really kind of a tragedy of exploitation of the women of the West, where in Montana, and I'm not quite sure about North Dakota, there were for a while traveling bands of strippers. So I took a white van and put four strippers and their enforcer in it and wove a tale of crime and corruption and actually love, hope, and redemption. It was such a surreal truth that how could I not put it in my story?
It ends with sort of a gritty good feeling. And, Keir, your story is Red Skies of Montana, and woven into your story is the diversity that is becoming very real everywhere.
Yes, absolutely. Again, as somebody who grew up in Missoula, my experience of Montana was very different from a lot of people's. I grew up next to the campus there and was grew up attending a lot of cultural events and met exchange students. And I wanted, in my story, I tried to do a lot of things in my story, but one of the things I tried to do was to kind of have a meeting between old and new Montana and represent some of that diversity through a protagonist who is from Mumbai and who meets some real Montanans in a very stressful kind of confrontation. It made sense to me to write with that character in part because I've now been away so long. I had to leave Montana to find opportunity to make a career in publishing. I go back as often as I can, and in my heart I'll always be a Montanan. But when I look back at it and I'm writing about it, I often feel a little bit like an outsider. And so I chose an outsider character to tell my story.
Well, Montana is a gigantic state which has a very distinct places in it, very different terrain and lots of contrast. And at the beginning of the collection, Montana Noir has a map of Montana with the towns that are featured in the stories highlighted with the outline of a body. So hence noir. But it's, I would think that the people in Great Falls and Helena and Butte and Missoula and Polson and Lolo and Billings and Jordan and Glasgow and Havre and Glendive would be thrilled to see their towns and stories.
We hope so. And we hope that it brings, really, in a way, we hope that it brings home to them that their stories matter, that the people of the small towns and cities of the West matter, that what they do every day matters. And if we can show that to them in an entertaining fashion, you know, we kind of feel like we've succeeded.
Well, this series of books, these noir books by Akashic Books, this series that I guess started back in 2004, and I mentioned it's got this very long list. They've got Helsinki noir, Istanbul noir, Moscow noir, Mumbai noir, lots of cities in the United States as well, but the whole world is here. Addis Ababa noir is in the works. And these are all assembled by people who know these places, right?
Right. They're all from there, and it's all, in a way, it's kind of a great literary experiment in that it's showing the kind of commonality between people all over the world. The stories that are in Montana noir have probably, I would say, parallel stories in Mumbai noir.
Yeah. Human nature is human nature.
You got it.
Are these books, though, targeted? I mean, it strikes me as kind of an interesting marketing approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, as you said, people in these towns in Montana are generally pretty excited to find their town showing up, even if it is Murder and Mayhem. But, I mean, people watch Murder and Mayhem and TV and movies. They read thrillers. So I think, nobody takes it personally necessarily if we happen to put the dead body in their hometown. But we knew the people of Montana would get behind this book, and that was something we tried to convey to the publisher when we were pitching this. Montana has always been a great literary state. I just saw an article the other day, that Montana is one of the leading states in terms of bookstores per capita. I always knew growing up in Missoula that I was surrounded by writers. I mean, we knew a lot of poets who also painted houses. There were just kind of writers everywhere, and a lot of writers come from elsewhere to be in Montana to surround themselves by that beautiful scenery and write. And so we were just always confident that the book would be well-received there, and as we said earlier, it's so far so good.
Well, what are you working on now?
I'm working on, as usual, a kind of a schizophrenic variety of projects. I've got an adult novel coming out under a pen name with my writing partner later this summer. We write under the name Linda Keir, and I also have a middle grade novel coming out also later this summer called The Phantom Tower, and I'm already pitching some other books to my agent.
How about you, James?
I'm actually working on a book called Empire Builder about the iconic train that goes not only from Seattle and through Montana, but through North Dakota.
James J.
And
Hill.
It's a modern, if you will, train robbery and more. It's a way for me to show the rest of the world the lives of the people along that railroad route that I love and in the country that made me who I am.
Well, we've got lots of towns in Minnesota and North Dakota that are named for board members of the Great Northern and James J. Hill and all of those folks that were working for him and their money backers in New York City as well. So, James, we're going to want you back to talk about the Empire Builder, that's for sure.
Got it. I'll be here.
James Grady, talking to us from Washington, D.C. A pleasure to have you with us. Keir Graff from Chicago. These are the editors of Montana Noir. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, now it's time to talk about the short and sweet membership drive underway right now at Prairie Public. This is where we're glad you count on Main Street to deliver, interesting, enlightening conversation. We like to think it is anyway. We like to tell stories that, tackle all kinds of interesting topics. And that's why we hope you listen to Main Street. That's maybe why you might want to consider becoming a member or upping your membership if you are a member. Give us a call at 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org. Now, a couple of times this week, we've played a little piece of what we call the Valentine's Song. It's sung by our director of radio, Bill Thomas, with a chorus of radioettes sings along with him. And this is to the tune of the Major General, one of the famous songs from the Pirates of Penzance. We call it the Valentine's Song, though. Here is Bill Thomas.
Are you the very model of the modern sorry Valentine? Your gifts and little sentiments, they never can arrive on time. Well, whether you're a modern lovesick gentleman or lady-o, we surely can assist you with this offer from your radio. Call us on the telephone, it only takes a little time. We'll take your contributions of the eleemosynary kind. Forget the silly tie with hearts or pink blouse with big ruffles. We will send out in your name a box of chocolate truffles.
We will send out in your name a box of chocolate truffles. We will send out in your name a box of chocolate truffles. We will send out in your name a box of chocolate truffles.
If you donate $120, we can send your love a box of them. Upon your head, they'll surely place the love achievement diadem. In short, you could be known as of the thoughtful and the loving kind and not live life derided as a very sorry Valentine.
In short, you could be known as the thoughtful and the loving kind and not live life derided as a very sorry Valentine.
If your sweetheart lives in Lidgerwood in Minot, Minto, or Fort Yates, a box of sweet, sweet truffles can most easily come to their gates. Mandan, Zap, or Center, Beulah, Mohaw, or Oakwood, Prairie Public membership and truffles surely would go good. We can't forget Mott Dickinson, Lakota, Larrabotano, Wapiton, or Williston Oaks, Ellendale, or Carpio, Emerado, Bismarck, Fargo, Jamestown, or Montpelier. Prairie Public chocolate will be perfect for your him or her.
All those chocolate truffles will be perfect for your him or her. All those chocolate truffles will be perfect for your him or her. All those chocolate truffles will be perfect for your him or him or her.
We'll send chocolate to your mother or to someone that you think is cute in Valley City, Grand Fork, Echo, Moorhead, or in Grassy Butte. In short, in Epping, Hillsborough, or anywhere on down the line, you will not live derided as a very sorry Valentine.
In short, in Epping, Hillsborough, or anywhere on down the line, you will not live derided as a very sorry Valentine.
On your phone, just dial the number from Mayville out to Old Glendive. 1-800-359, then 41, and then 45. Pembina to Amadon, Enderlin to Battleview. Then prepare your plastic Visa or a MasterCard will do. Call or grab your keyboard and click us when you go online. And we will send the chocolate to your sweet and loving Valentine. You'll help to pay the bills for shows at public radio. As truffles come to charm the tongue and warm up your dear bellerbow.
Truffles come to charm the tongue and warm up your dear bellerbow. Truffles come to charm the tongue and warm up your dear bellerbow. Truffles come to charm the tongue and warm up your dear bell or bellerbow.
In Bobel's Armadina, Verona, Crete, or Castleton, in Airvoss, Inkster, Pettibone, Alcobo, or Richardton, you'll help your public radio. That will make you feel so fine. You'll also be remembered as a very thoughtful Valentine.
You'll help your public radio, and that will make you feel so fine. You'll also be remembered as a very thoughtful Valentine.
Well, that's that. That is the Valentine song featuring Bill Thomas and some of the rest of us. And we won't play it again if you start calling right now. 800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org. It's our short and sweet membership drive, and this is our reminder that we are member-supported radio. We'll be back with more Main Street, including our weekly Friday news chat with News Director Dave Thompson, right after the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. About 70 supporters gathered for a We Are Savannah rally at the Sanctuary Event Center in Fargo last night, a day before sentencing for one of the people who admitted killing her pregnant neighbor, 22-year-old Savannah Graywin, last August. Lenora King was among those on hand to remember Savannah's memory and hoping justice is served.
The impact on our community, it still is impacting us so much, and this is just bringing back right now so much. Hazley's here, and she's growing, and she's so beautiful.
Hazley Joe was at the rally with her father, Savannah's boyfriend, Ashton Matheny. Brooke Cruz, who admitted killing Savannah Graywind so she could keep the baby, was sentenced this afternoon in district court in Fargo. Judge Frank Rasick sentenced her to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Cruz's boyfriend, William Hain, is facing the same charges and has pleaded not guilty. He's scheduled to go on trial in May. The U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration pledged this week to work more closely on food safety. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach explains how more teamwork may help better align the two agencies that watch over the nation's food supply.
In general, the USDA is in charge of meat safety, while the FDA handles all other foods. So companies that make food with various ingredients, like frozen pizza, have to work with both agencies. That gets complicated because each department has its own record system.
It's like having someone who has a Mac and someone who has a PC.
That's food safety researcher Angela Shaw of Iowa State University. In a new agreement, the USDA and FDA plan to reduce the number of facilities they oversee together. The first thing the agency should do, Shaw says, is line up their data collection. If they do, she says it could pay off with both faster recalls and less paperwork for food companies. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And by federal law, banks cannot give loans to manufacturers or dispensaries of medical marijuana. They also can't take deposits. That's because marijuana is listed as a Schedule I drug, meaning it is still illegal no matter what states decide to do. And since banks are federally regulated, they have to follow those guidelines. When North Dakota's medical marijuana law passed, Governor Doug Burgum asked the state-owned Bank of North Dakota to look at whether the bank, because of its special status, could allow loans or deposits. Bank President Eric Hardmeyer says he talked with federal regulators about it, and the conclusion:
we're much like any other bank. We're in the same kind of shoes as the others are in terms of, federal regulations, working with the Fed. You know, they have a significant hammer that they could use, and that is they could pull our routing number, which essentially shuts us down.
Ann Hardmeyer says other banks would not work with the state-owned facility if it would allow loans or deposits from medical marijuana facilities.
Until the federal government takes action on this, either by removing this from the controlled substance list or passing legislation to allow banks to operate field, we're simply not in a position to do anything in this area.
Hardmeyer says it will likely take an act of Congress to remove medical marijuana from the Schedule I list. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, when we hear that news wire in the background, it's time to talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, who's by our microphone in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
You've had an interesting week this week. I just saw filed today, conservationists hope to start conversations about Western North Dakota energy development, and I didn't realize that there was no planning document, apparently.
Apparently there is no planning document. That at least is the concern of the North Dakota Wildlife Federation and also this Badlands Alliance. They're saying that they've asked for strategic planning, so to make sure there's orderly development and to make sure that the grasslands are protected and some of the other great areas in North Dakota are protected, then they're asking for a conversation. They're not coming out and saying the oil industry is a bad actor. They're saying, hey, let's talk about this and let's make sure that development is orderly going forward.
Well, we were reminded of the sensitivity of that part of the state with the Davis Refinery proposed between Belfield and Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
So did you know the Davis Refineries has already gotten more than 11,000 comments?
Really?
Yes.
Well, the deadline was last Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So the health department is... That decision is still pending, I take it.
That's correct, and that's the air quality decision.
Okay. Well, meanwhile, oil prices are something that North Dakota politicians keep an eye on, Rich Wardner among them.
That's correct. You're talking about oil prices now that are between $60 and $70. Didn't check the current prices, but Rich Wardner is saying, yeah, it looks good right now, but if OPEC decides, okay, this is enough, and pulls the plug on its idea of limiting production, well, the prices may drop back to $20 or $30 a barrel. You know, OPEC did that earlier because there were worries about the shale plays in the United States. And now, with the production controls on them, the shale plays are, roaring back. which is a good thing.
Well, considering what happened, that is, when the prices went south, it's probably a good idea for everybody to keep looking over their shoulder at OPEC.
Right. And that's basically, you know, burned once, twice careful.
Uh-huh. Third time, I guess I'm the
third
fool.
Third time, yes.
Okay. Medical marijuana suppliers and growers may have trouble with banks. There's nothing new about this. This has been an issue in those other states.
It certainly has. I'll tell you why I decided to go with a story on that is I was listening to a story from NPR about how Colorado's handling it, and apparently there's some who are thinking about having non-FDIC-protected banks to handle some of the loans and some of the cash, because you can't even put deposits in these banks because it is a Schedule I drug. And I was thinking, okay, we've got medical marijuana coming in North Dakota. And I guess these people who are going to have the grow centers or the compassion centers are going to have cash on the barrelhead to get this done. And it's cash-only business right now. And where are you going to put this money? And that's I found it a real question. And I do know that the Bank of North Dakota was contacted by the Brigham administration saying, you know, what about the Bank of North Dakota being a place for this? And, well, the Bank of North Dakota happens to fall under the same regulations that other banks do, so FDIC would come down and say, uh-uh, you're not doing this.
Well, the stories from those other states that have medical and or recreational marijuana is that because it's a cash-only business, that does make people feel a bit vulnerable at
Absolutely.
These businesses.
It's very risky at this point. And, of course, if you're thinking it's cash-only business, you've got cash on hand, well, you maybe some people will try to get their hands on that cash illegally.
Yeah, okay. Well, speaking of the Bank of North Dakota, as we just were, you had a story earlier this week. There's little demand for special drought farm loan programs.
Right, and they set these up wondering if there was going to be, especially from livestock producers who were selling off livestock herds because there wasn't enough feed. Well, somehow they got other programs to get feed out there, and there was a loan program to rebuild some of the livestock herds. That's not being used. And in talking to the bank president, Eric Hardmeyer, he says crop insurance came in at a pretty good time. So farmers are feeling pretty good about it. However, we've got a new crop year in 2018. And right now it looks like a lot of the state may be in that drought condition yet.
All right. So maybe it's time to look at those drought programs and maybe tweak them for.
Right. And I think they're keeping open. And although there's been very little use of the programs that are available right now, maybe there will be if we continue to be dry.
We have a candidate for Secretary of State besides the incumbent.
That's right. Actually, we have two. We have an interparty challenge to Al Jager.
Mm-hmm.
He's got it's a district chairman from Mandan, Republican district chairman. And now we have the first Democrat who's announced, that's Joshua Boucher of Fargo, who has made a pretty good splash. He went around the state, did some news conferences. And his big thing, a couple of big things in his issues, said we need to modernize the office and we need to make sure that we don't do any kind of voter registration. Now, the person from Mandan who's challenging Jager on the Republican side says he thinks maybe it's time for voter registration. So there's going to be some interesting issues when we get to the race for Secretary of State.
It's interesting to me that there's an interparty tug of war on this one.
Right. And I think you're going to find more. There are some legislative races where we're seeing some interparty tug of war. And there was a fight, not a fight, but a race in District 47 for the state Senate seat that was being vacated there. And everybody thought it was going to be the deputy attorney general was going to win that one. Well, he lost to the former state water commissioner.
Mm.
So
your alma mater is going to replace its steam plant, which would be a big investment, but it's
gonna
not going to be
investment.
Asking for a state appropriation. That is interesting.
Right. What they're going to do is go to the private market, borrow some money, and then they've got other users besides just UND dorms and UND buildings for it. All True, for example, is a user. The School for the Blind is a user. There are a couple other users, Grand Forks Public Schools. They say they will replace the plant, go with private financing and have their customers pay for it. But the key on that is they want to keep rates down for the steam. And they're working on plans to do that.
Well, this is interesting because the university then would be in the business of providing heat energy to other businesses.
Right. And they're being encouraged to do so by the Board of Higher Education saying, you know, it's a way in a time when you know, funding is not plentiful. This may be a way to, A, partner with communities, B, come up with something that's entrepreneurial, thinking outside the box.
All right. Well, we've got to finish with this because I saw the video, Dave. KXMB TV in Bismarck did a piece about you, which even included them coming back and pitching video of you singing karaoke. It was wonderful.
You thought it was wonderful? Thank
you. I did. You've got a great voice.
Oh, I appreciate that. They said, are you a karaoke master? I said, no, I'm a karaoke practitioner.
Well, from what I heard, we maybe should think about this for the next short and sweet membership drive in, offering this. Yeah, yeah, if we get this much money, Dave Thompson will sing a little karaoke for
us. Oh, my. Okay. Don't fear the chocolate.
Please.
Yeah,
let's add a little sweetness to this.
Why
besides
not?
Just the cocoa truffles.
There you go.
Every Friday we talk to our news director. It's always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
And Main Street will be continuing in just a few more moments. I know that we've got Matt's movie review is coming up in the next few minutes. But before we get to that, Doug and I, Danielle Webster, obviously, we would like to talk to you again about our short and sweet membership drive. We are coming to you because it is that time again where we are hoping to count on you for a contribution of support in any amount for the programming that you have come to rely on each day, like Main Street, like Morning Edition, like All Things Considered, like This American Life, like Into the Music with Mike Olson, all sorts of great programs here in Prairie Public, and we can't bring any of it to you without that listener support. So call right now, 1-800-359-4145. That's 800-359-4145, and make a contribution. You can also pledge online at prairiepublic.org.
Gerald and Jan Saylor and Hedinger have given that gift that keeps on giving to Prairie Public. We appreciate their support and hope they enjoy that box of Nicole's Cocoa Truffles. And also from Mandan, North Dakota, a wonderful gift to Prairie Public and some truffles going out that way as well. As you probably know, this is our short and sweet membership drive. It is short. It's over tomorrow around midday. So time's a-wasting for us to remind you that we love the fact that you're listening. But we need members. And maybe you've been listening for a long time and some members have been paying it forward for you. Maybe it's your turn now. At any rate, we're asking because we need your help. 800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org.
And we had a couple of other callers this afternoon as well. These folks wanted to remain anonymous. We had a call from Jamestown and a call as well from Bismarck. And we see a lot of anonymous donors or just folks that don't want their name to be read on the air during the short and sweet membership drive because, quite frankly, a lot of folks rely on this drive not only to support their public radio listening habit but to also take care of their Valentine's Day obligations.
Yeah.
Maybe they're sending Valentine's to their kids away at college or to their significant other or to their mom or to their grandma or you know, to themselves. I'm definitely one of those people that believes in a Valentine for yourself, and we definitely are in support of that here at Prairie Public. What you can do is give us a call this afternoon. That number is 800-359-4145. That's 800-359-4145. Or you can pledge online at prairiepublic.org. It only takes a couple of minutes, and your $10 monthly gift of support to Prairie Public will earn you a free box of those cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry. Now, if you want to send one to yourself and send one to another friend, if you want to send out multiple boxes of chocolates, our volunteers can definitely work with you on that and help you set that up as well. 1-800-359-4145. That's 800-359-4145. The important thing is that you make that decision to give this afternoon and support the public radio programs that you have come to rely on here on Prairie Public. 800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org, and we thank you.
Well, there's the fanfare that says the curtain's going up on another movie review with Matt Olean. And Matt, you've got a couple of movies this week because there are a lot of movies out there.
And a lot of them are up for Oscars right now. And I saw two of the last two films I needed to see to round out the 9 Best Picture nominees that I've seen. Let's start with The Post, Steven Spielberg's film about the release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971 that I'm sure you remember, Doug, by Daniel Ellsberg, a former Department of Defense operative who feels that things are not going well in Vietnam. And it's based on a Robert McNamara report that was hidden for years. And, of course, it blew the lid off Vietnam, essentially. And the story is really about the New York Times getting the scoop first and then being forced to not publish more papers because the Justice Department steps in and the judge says you can't do this because it's top secret. And then the Washington Post gets involved as well.
Yeah.
And Tom Hanks plays Ben Bradley, famously played by Jason Robards in All the President's Men. And Meryl Streep plays Katharine Graham, the longtime publisher of the Post, who has a lot of decisions to make in a job she was not expecting to ever have following the suicide of her husband, Phil. So it's really it's a solid film as long as it kind of sticks to the nuts and bolts of a newspaper film. You know, reporters getting sources, talking to people, getting to the bottom of things. There's some good scenes with Hanks trying to cajole Streep into letting him publish the stories he wants to, whereas she's more hesitant about these things. But it is not in All the President's Men's territory in terms of a great newspaper film. In fact, it's pretty good until the last act, and then things unravel. And I must say that in the end, Spielberg succumbs to his lifelong Achilles heel, Doug, if he has one, and that is sentiment and preachiness and messages. As the film wraps up, he sort of, I'm not going to give away scenes, but he tries to check a few boxes in terms of gender equality, gender roles, which on the surface is an admirable thing to do, but he does it in such a clumsy fashion with a couple of TV movie-ish, mawkish, cloying scenes near the end of the film that you're kind of like, did he just take a bathroom break and let Clint Eastwood direct these scenes? Because they're so mawkish and so amateurish that I think any kind of statement he's trying to make gets washed away. And that's really my problem with this film is it's a film that doesn't really know what it wants to be. And Spielberg kind of screws it up in the end. I didn't really care for this film much, even though a lot of people have liked it.
Oh, that's a shame, because this is one of those very important stories in American journalism, and certainly in the 20th century, one of the biggest stories of that century. And it's an interesting one for those of us who were around at that time, and for those who weren't, it's an interesting lesson.
And if you want to go for a history lesson, that's fine. But as a piece of filmmaking, my job is to come in and not give Steven Spielberg a pass. Mm-hmm. And honestly, he needs to be held to a higher bar than this, because some of the latter-day Spielberg films look a little old-fashioned to me. I mean, I like Bridge of Spies, I like Lincoln, but compared to the product that younger directors are putting on screen, I think some of his later films look a little stale, look a little old-fashioned, and I just wonder if the script – well, the script needed a lot more work on the Post as well. There's also almost too many characters, Doug. There's a lot of scenes where Katharine Graham's board members are like swarming over her and mansplaining to her, which is another key part of the film. And I almost felt like, who are all these people? She refers to them in first name basis as if the audience should know who they are, and we really don't know who they are. So there's almost too many characters, I think, and the script needed a lot of work here. And as far as Hanks goes, you know, he gives it his all as Bradley, but Jason Robards defines that role. And I think Tom is slightly miscast as Bradley and not quite as good. And as for Meryl Streep, you know, she's good as Katharine Graham, but I walked out of the theater going, why didn't Jessica Chastain get that fifth nomination, that fifth spot for Molly's Game? Because that's a much better performance. And I think the answer is because Jessica Chastain's name is not Meryl Streep.
Yeah, well, Meryl Streep has had quite a run in nominations.
She has, but she shouldn't have been nominated for this.
Let's talk about The Phantom Thread.
Like this one a lot better. Paul Thomas Anderson, one of the best of what I call the video store generation of film directors that have come up, people born in the 70s and late 60s. And this is along the lines of some of his masterpieces like There Will Be Blood and The Master. And it's about a fashion designer played by Daniel Day-Lewis. The designer's name is Reynolds Woodcock. And he is a fashion designer in 1950s London, and he's a fussy man. He likes things his way. He's obsessive. He's OCD. And he meets a waitress in a restaurant played by Vicky Krapes, who is a Luxembourg actress. And she becomes kind of his muse and his lover. And she becomes kind of the person he tries dresses on. And this kind of yin and yang, this relationship they have really becomes the basis of the film. And also, his partner in the industry is his sister, played by Leslie Manville. And this is an icy, cold, wonderful supporting performance. She was up. She's up for the supporting actress Oscar, and she earned it. And so we're kind of in Rebecca territory here, Doug. You know, the Demarié book that Hitchcock directed. You've got the Elma, played by Vicky Krieps, coming in to live with him, and his sister lives there. And it's this jealousy, this brother-sister jealousy going on. Remember Mrs. Danvers and Rebecca, who was so jealous of the new Mrs. De Winter, played by Joan Fontaine. And so we're back into that territory. But Anderson's artistry is all over this film. He's so good at directing scenes, so good at directing actors. Everything that you see on screen, from Daniel Day-Lewis being annoyed by the way Elma butters her toast, that bothers him, because he's very, very particular about things. That's interesting. Everything Daniel Day-Lewis does on screen is interesting. I think he's the best actor since Brando. It's not the fire and brimstone role that he had in Gangs of New York or There'll Be Blood, but he's allowed to play a quiet, obsessive man, and it's a brilliant performance as he goes out into the sunset, supposedly retiring.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. This is supposed to be his last role in film, right?
That's what he says. He got another Oscar nomination. Honestly, I'd be okay with him winning a fourth Oscar. I don't think he's going to. I think he's going to lose to his contemporary, Gary Oldman. But he's great in the film. Vicky Krieps is great in the film. Leslie Manville is great. It's one of my top five or six films of the year. I do think, I want to warn mainstream audiences, it does kind of go at a leisurely pace. There's kind of a Stanley Kubrick feel to this film, who Anderson has sometimes been compared to. There is a plot twist that might leave people baffled, like, what is going on here? But I was okay with the plot twist. I was okay with how things resolved themselves. And I like this film an awful lot.
Oh, these are two films I want to see, The Post and Phantom Thread. Now, we've talked about the A-list actors in both of these movies,
yes,
so maybe
have.
This is a way too simple Academy Award question. But among these three, Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks, and Daniel Day-Lewis, there are eight Oscar wins.
Yes.
And Streep beats everybody with nominations. She's got 21 so far. Let's get the wins.
Okay.
Which one were Meryl Streep's?
1979, Kramer versus Kramer. 1982, Sophie's Choice. And 2011 for The Iron Lady.
Right.
And then Tom Hanks back-to-back in 1993 for Philadelphia and the next year for Forrest Gump. And Mr. Day-Lewis for My Left Foot, 1989. There'll Be Blood, 2007. And Lincoln, 2012.
You scored 100%. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Daybook for February 2nd. North Dakota remembers World War I. In December of 1917, George M. Cohen's little ditty, Over There, was sold to a New York publisher for $25,000. Representing a payment of $161 a word or $138 a note. It became the highest payment per word for any composition up to that time. This leaped significantly ahead of the $2 per word payment for an article written by Theodore Roosevelt, its next closest rival. And compared to a complete Puccini opera of that era, Over There topped it by a whopping $10,000. The song promised that with drums rum-tumming, the Yanks were coming, and they wouldn't come home until it's over, over there. This came to symbolize America's commitment to the war and the patriotic fever of the American soldier. By the middle of January of 1918, the North Dakota boys were over there. Companies of the 1st and 2nd North Dakota regiments, splintered and scattered, were quickly sent as replacements for the weary, battle-depleted troops who arrived with General Pershing back in July of 1917. It was only a matter of time before the casualty lists came back with familiar names from North Dakota. Private Lewis Owsley was from Wilton. With his brother Lawrence, he had joined Company A of the 2nd Regiment, originally stationed to protect the railroad bridge at Camp Fraser in Bismarck before shipping off to France. While it was true that other soldiers from North Dakota had died with the Canadian forces or from disease, it was on this date in 1918 that Lewis Owsley became the first soldier from North Dakota regiments to be killed in action. Owsley was with a small detachment in an advanced position in No Man's Land, a killing zone situated between the trenches of the battling forces when they came under heavy machine gun fire and artillery fire. As they retreated, their lieutenant leading the squad was severely wounded. Owsley tossed his weapon to another soldier, and oblivious to the rifle and machine gun fire, he raced back and hoisted the officer on his shoulder. Stumbling through the mud and debris, he picked his way through the shell craters. As he neared the safety of the American trenches, he was hit with a burst of shrapnel. His comrades completed the rescue of the officer and then secured Owsley's lifeless body. The wounded officer survived, and North Dakota's first casualty was a hero. As in Cohen's song, "Hoist the flag and let her fly, like true heroes, do or die." For Private Louis Owsley, it was over. Over there. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Just a couple of minutes left in Main Street to remind you about our short and sweet membership drive. It is short. It is sweet. If you come in at a $10 a month sustaining membership level, that's $120 a year. You get that pound of very fine cocoa truffles from the Cole's Fine Pastry. Someday we should actually post a video of these things being made because they are handmade. Those are quality materials that they use. The ingredients are wonderful. The truffles, as a result, are the real deal. And if you want a box of truffles, just a phone call away, 800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org. It doesn't take but a moment, and it's very important that our listeners consider membership, because membership actually pays the bills. Listeners make us feel good about what we're doing. We are public radio, after all, and that's an important part of our mission. We're part of the fabric of the state of North Dakota. We try to reflect the issues and the important stories that people are talking about, and that, you know, just the kinds of things that connect us as opposed to separate us. This is Prairie Public, and its mission is you. If you're listening right now, this is an opportunity to become a member, and we value our members. We'd like to talk with you, as a matter of fact. We like to interact with our members. We like to know what's on your mind, what you want to hear, what it is that we do that you like, and frankly, what it is we do that you don't like. Give us a call, 1-800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org. It's especially important this year. Our membership roles are the most important part of our budget. So we're asking you, if you haven't considered this before, to consider it this time around. 800-359-4145. Monday on Main Street, we'll preview one of the participating organizations in Giving Hearts Day. Peter Schultz is the founder of the Long Spur Prairie Fund. He'll talk about his fund's unique mission. And we'll talk with Sonia Jensen about her work with Prairie Public to develop fundraising software that resulted in Allegiance Software. It's a company that serves nonprofits around the country. And, of course, we hope you'll check in on Main Street Weekend this Sunday at 10 a.m. Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.